All right, the mics are live, and this operation is underway. Can you hear us in the back? And I'm talking about the West Side neighborhood table in the back. My name is Rick Pluta. I am the State Capitol Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, and I am so happy to bring It's Just Politics and Issues and Ale to my hometown of Lansing. I am joined by the lovely and talented co-host of It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark.
Hi, everyone. Hi.
And the lovely and talented state capitol correspondent for the Detroit News, Chad Livengood.
Yay!
Who I should also point out for this wall of West Siders is also a Lansing West Sider.
Do you want to give his address? Social Security number?
Are you being recorded?
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. This is being recorded and not just by the NSA. Okay, a little bit of business to get out of the way. Welcome and thank you. Issues and Ales is an event series sponsored by Michigan Radio designed to engage people in conversations about important issues facing Michigan in a fun and informal atmosphere. We would like to thank Sam Short and the staff of Zubies. By the way, is Matt the bartender here? He's not, because this was his idea. So we'd like to thank Zubies for inviting us all here tonight.
Thank you.
I was joking because I was just reading the outset. You guys are a big part of this. That raise your hand if you have a question or something to offer, because that's what this is about. It is a two-way conversation that we want to hear what you have to say, answer your questions. So Steve over here. Yeah. Oh, yeah, see? Someone's starting already. Troublemaker. So we want to hear from you. Also, right up front here is a box where you can put in your entry for a Michigan Radio Issues and Ale fun prize packet. And I should warn you, just to start this off with scandal, Zoe Clark has already stuffed the ballot box.
I just wanted some folks who were not here tonight to have a chance, but Steve Kropinski told me that if those people were chosen, he would toss them out. So need not worry. Someone in this room will win the prize.
Must be present to win.
Must be present to win.
Right, exactly. Well, so let's start this evening off talking about what's going on in the legislature this week. This is the last week before lawmakers head home for the session. One of the big issues that we're keeping an eye on is the Right to Life initiated law. How many people have been keeping an eye on this? Hands. Okay. Well, so let's go to the lovely and talented Rick Pluta to explain first what a initiated law is and what this law would do.
Last year, Governor Snyder vetoed a bill because it included in it a provision that would require people who want abortion coverage for most of abortions to buy basically a separate policy. And he vetoed it because he said there were no exceptions for instances of rape or incest. This sort of thing has happened before. As a matter of fact, I believe the last three governors of Michigan at different times for different reasons have vetoed abortion-related legislation in one instance, even though we had someone who was a pro-life governor, and Right to Life of Michigan, which has a beyond formidable capacity to run a ballot drive, a petition drive, spent last summer gathering signatures, submitted them to put an initiated law before the legislature, which has 40 days within its session period, which ends this week, but it will resume in mid-January of next year, to vote on it, to vote for it, and it becomes a law without the governor's signature, to reject it, in which case it goes to the ballot, or to not vote at all, in which case it goes to the ballot. And Chad, I think we were pretty confident that, I mean, there was almost no question that the legislature was going to vote this week before they left for the year.
There was no question.
To vote on it. There was no question.
But now there's about 48 hours left in the clock, and they have not acted, and they are continuing to be non-committal
to
doing it.
So what are the politics behind this? Back in the beginning of October, October 8th to be exact, Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville's first started looking like he was sort of dragging his feet.
He was equivocating.
Right to Life isn't going to sort of tell us when we're going to vote on it. He said it wasn't a top priority. Is this some sort of intra-party fight between him, between Right to Life? What's going on here?
Within the conservative movement, they don't want to look like they're being bullied and run over by Right to Life, although that has happened before. So, they're trying to try to put together the votes. They have the votes. I mean,
they have the votes to pass it.
Right.
But there is a technical issue, which is called immediate effect. And what it does is the Michigan Constitution says that that most laws that are passed will not become effective until 90 days after the end of the session. And the idea was that if you were passing new regulations, taxes, whatever, that people, businesses should have time to get a sense of what's going on and prepare for it. But in some instances, we would allow a law to go into effect right away because there's a crisis, some immediate need, and that motion is called immediate effect, and all you have to do is get a two-thirds supermajority in the House and a two-thirds supermajority in the Senate, and it's not an issue. It used to be quite rare in the early days of this Constitution in the 60s and the 70s. Now it's become very common, and on some occasions it becomes a pretty fierce procedural fight, and that's where we're at right now, because if they end the year without voting on this and they go into next year and they can't get immediate effect and they don't have the votes in the House to do it, and we can talk about vote counting later, then that means that this law doesn't take effect until 2015 if and when they pass it.
So what we know about initiated laws is that the governor can't veto them, that once they pass the legislature, if they do, the governor can't really say yes or no. What about a ballot? Could we possibly see a different ballot drive come November 2014 that would then sort of counteract this if immediate effect takes place?
There could be a ballot drive that essentially tries to repeal this or fights back at it. So you could have
We saw this happen in the late 80s with Medicaid funded abortions.
Right. And we already have looks like we're going to have two different competing wolf hunting bills, or maybe three actually.
Three when you count the people who are doing
two to repeal wolf hunting and one to allow it, and then we possibly have the scenario where we have two competing abortion initiatives on one thing with the immediate effect. There's something of intrigue with this, which is the legislature doesn't, the House does not have the votes for a two-thirds majority. The House Republicans, I should say. They commonly, when they do have bipartisan bills, they do give it immediate effect, and there would technically be the votes. The Senate has the Republicans in the Senate have a supermajority. But so the House does something called the fast gavel, which is like, okay, it has immediate effect. You're all standing
there's,
up.
There's a motion for immediate effect. Bang, immediate effect is ordered, and
It has immediate effect, and they just consider it done, even though there's technically not two-thirds people voting for it. In fact, you could probably hear two-thirds vote people, or at least hear half of the people in the chamber saying no. So
you will not find fast gavel in Robert's Rules of Order.
Right, right. So in not doing this, or not, because Right to Life is telling the legislative leadership, we don't want you to try to fast gavel this, because that could leave this thing open to a court challenge, which in of itself is kind of an admission that they're unconstitutionally fast-gaveling immediate effect laws to begin with. But and the Republicans in the legislature for the last year have been taking a little bit of precaution with big bills not to do that, because there's a concern that this could end up overturned by a court someday. Even though the Michigan Court of Appeals has said has essentially sided with them. The Sixth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals in Cincinnati has kind of chided the legislature.
Well, and
about
there's this issue of the judicial branch then coming in and saying, no, look, legislative branch, this is how you need to rule. This is that. And so there's some sticky.
What's happened is the Michigan Court of Appeals has said the judicial branch will not tell the legislative branch how to count votes, even when it's apparent that they're not counting the votes. And what the Democrats have done has now gone – they've gone to the federal courts, which is why they're before the Sixth Circuit, and hoping to get basically a sort of a due process ruling. But what's – there are two things that are fascinating about this, because it's just another fracture that we're seeing in within the conservative movement, that first of all, we have – A conservative Republican legislature, or at least their leadership, standing up to Right to Life and the anti-abortion lobby and saying no to as far as they can stretch that they're not going to win on the issue itself, that this will become a law. But they're saying that we're going to make it a hassle for you for whatever reasons. That's part one. Republican leadership standing up to Right to Life in the anti-abortion lobby, which is almost unheard of.
Well,
but
we heard
not
it,
entirely.
We heard it explained earlier today to us. It's a parent telling their kid to clean their room in 5 minutes, and the kid's like, "Oh, I'll clean it, but in 6 minutes, right?" It's this holding of a little bit of power. You're still going to do it. Your parent is still making you clean your room, but you're holding out some little bit of ownership.
To take that analogy one step further.
And we've got a question over there. And then the second part of it is Right to Life, the anti-abortion, the primary element within the anti-abortion movement, looking at the House Republicans and saying, don't get our issue caught up in your sleazy procedural tactics.
Right. But the problem, this gets a little more complicated, because if they do try to give it an immediate effect and it does go up for a court challenge, and say this scenario, just for scenario's purposes, this one law becomes the overturning of a law because of the immediate effect. It could be used to overturn other important laws to the legislature they've passed in the last 3 years.
The emergency manager law?
Emergency manager law is number one, and because of the situation in Detroit right now.
Yeah.
And that's why they did not give immediate effect to Right to Work last year.
And actually,
no doubt about that.
No, absolutely. And Rachel Maddow, if you're Rachel Maddow fans, this was actually one of the first issues that she took up looking at the Michigan legislature. She's done a lot on immediate effect. So I think we've got a question in the back.
So on this Right to Life issue, right? They actually do have the votes to do immediate effect with the actual
in
vote
the Senate.
In
no,
the Senate.
In the Senate.
But
they
not
do
in
not,
the
they
House?
Do not have it in the House. Right. There's a two-thirds Republican majority in the Senate. There's not a two-thirds Republican majority in the House. And the House Democrats will hang together on this procedural question.
Do you think that there's any kind of political sea change happening on terms of Right to Life issues in this state, that it could cost a Senate Republican or a House Republican to be super for?
Not in 2014, no.
Not in 2014.
And let's note, too, there are some Democrats who have said that they would vote as well. Not a lot of them, but there are some Democrats that
But the Democrats
will
not
well.
Vote with the Republicans on this process, because even though it might seem a little weird that this whole issue of immediate effect is a live wire in the state capitol, that immediate effect is sort of immediate effect in the Michigan capitol is a little bit like what the filibuster is in the United States capitol.
Or the nuclear option.
Well, but that's what the nuclear option
right,
is about,
right.
That the filibuster is the mechanism for the minority to exert some control over the situation. And the majority, you know, in the case of the Senate, it's the Democrats. In the case of the U.S. Senate, in the case of the Michigan House, it's been the Republicans saying, we're going to deny you that. And this is the minority going, here is your comeuppance.
So I think we should talk about marijuana.
Yeah.
Dude, yeah.
What do we think about that?
Just talk.
We have a plethora of weed, Mary Jane, whatever you want to
call
it.
Who calls it Mary Jane?
No, I'm not. Medical marijuana.
Mary Jane in the back there.
Hands up. Tom Petty does, Bob Scott, our chief engineer, says. So there are four bills right now in this legislature having to do with medical marijuana. Let's talk about a few of them, because right now the House has been passing them through various panels. Let's first talk about medibles. These are edible forms of marijuana, so maybe brownies, drops of those.
Zoe,
kind of
you're
things.
In Lansing. You do not have to explain medibles to us.
A lot of this is being pushed by the fact that the 2008 medical marijuana law had a lot of shortcomings. It was very vague about who is a caregiver, where does marijuana come from? Essentially, it doesn't even really say who exactly is to be allowed to grow it, or if even. The dispensaries, that's one of the big legal issues.
One of the questions is, where does marijuana come from? I feel like I'm sitting in my college
when
dorm.
When a man room. And a woman really love each
where
other.
Where does medical marijuana come from? Marijuana comes from the street outside here, but where does medical marijuana come from is really undefined. And so the legislature has been slowly trying to figure out how to make this law kind of work, because they realize that the public sentiment has changed, that this is accepted, that there's a sea change going on in this country right now on medical marijuana and its usefulness.
One of the interesting things was, in the past couple of years, for example, we had court decisions that struck down dispensaries. And, I mean, people who live in Lansing remember how after
many of them.
the medical marijuana initiative was passed, that Michigan Avenue all around here,
Martin Luther King.
Who lived 50 yards from a medical marijuana dispensary?
Right.
You know, I was born and raised in Ann Arbor and lived there. I'm not that square.
they were going up everywhere here, and then the Court of Appeals ruled in a case out of Mount Pleasant, and they got shut down. But what was the hole that was left there was growing things is not an exact science. And there was this big question, what do you do about the leftover weed?
Right.
And, you know, it's
how do you transport it? That's another
how do you transport it? What do you do with it? And dispensaries, it was eventually realized, even by the law and order types, were the solution, not the problem.
And we're seeing some strange bedfellows here, right? When it comes to a lot of this different medical marijuana law, we see some lawmakers who are on the far left, and then some Republican lawmakers, Mike Colton, who might consider themselves more libertarian, saying that the government shouldn't be the ones who are making these laws. And then you've got someone like Jeff Irwin who's saying, let's just throughout the state, you know, decrim.
There's also just the underlying issue of if you don't know where it's coming from, whether it's been tested or whether it's really, what kind of chemicals were used on it. So that's one of the things that they're trying to figure out.
How strong is it?
Yeah, it's the potency and whatnot. And there are some companies that have been formed around the state that are doing this service, but they have to go almost to one caregiver after another, and who only has four or five plants or four or five patients. And so the idea is to try to streamline it. And essentially, if you're going to call it medicine, let's regulate it like medicine.
And this is serious stuff, because what we've seen with illegal drugs, and I'm primarily thinking of heroin and cocaine, but others, is a lot of the problems aren't as much with the drug itself, but not knowing what are the byproducts that have been used as a part of making that drug, and what is the strength of the drug itself. That one day you're using something that's X strength, the next time you're using it, it's X times three or four.
But,
and that's what leads to a lot of bad, sometimes fatal stuff.
Let's talk a little bit then about this legislation that is going pretty quickly through the legislature right now, and that has to do with this idea that if and when the federal government okayed medical marijuana, that pharmacies would actually be able to go and get it from a certain kind of facility, would then be able to sell it so that you would be able to, let's say a hospital could then get, you know, 40 milligrams or however you want to talk about it. So why is that moving so quickly through the legislature when right now...
Because Big Pharma recognized that this is coming.
So is that the issue then, that now we're seeing a majority of folks saying yes?
Oh, sure. The sponsor of that bill is Senator Roger Kahn, who's a doctor, and when he realizes that this is the next thing, he's jumping on board.
And former Speaker of the House Chuck Perricone has a group, I think, in Canada, who's
right.
really
well,
got some money.
There's a company
this.
In Canada that handles this, yeah. And they've been pushing this, and it is yes that the legitimate, yeah. quote unquote. Drug makers are already, looking ahead to the time when marijuana, medicinal or otherwise, will be legal in at least some parts of the United States.
Let's be honest. It's easier to get policymakers to agree to
We're
something.
We're talking about politics.
Why are we here?
Absolutely not.
It's easier to get policymakers to agree to something that's being regulated by a certain company or essentially built in mass than it is for just sort of the widespread grow it out of your backyard or in your basement or in your attic approach that was essentially going on. And it'll bring a little bit of sense of order to it. It'll stop, maybe it'll stop Jessica Cooper, an Oakland County prosecutor, from having people kicked in their doors and stuff, trying, checking out who's growing and who's not. And the other thing, they're just trying to clear up a lot of this issue is where there's so many scenarios with handling medical marijuana versus illegal marijuana. And how do you do that? And there's a case right now, I think it's before the Supreme Court,
yeah.
City of Wyoming, had an ordinance that said you couldn't grow this here. And there was a guy that was growing it in his house, and he had a license, and they tried to bust him on it, and he's suing and trying to challenge that. So there's so many facets. I can't even tell you how many court cases there have been.
Yeah, it makes me want just a huge bag of Cheetos, really, and just put it back. And...
The legislature sees they got to step up and do something here. Their job.
Yeah. So let's
Let's have one.
Is there a reason, as opposed to the tobacco lobby, has any fingers in any of this?
The question was, does the tobacco lobby have a hand in any of this legislation?
No, not as far as I know. I mean, I just think that it's a separate industry, but who knows? Right now, the tobacco lobby is a lot more caught up in the electronic cigarette. The electronic cigarette, not controversy.
And I think we have a question in the back. Steve Kropinski, yeah.
For the less well-informed, what's the current mechanism that medical users get their marijuana now?
They apply to the Department of Community Health for a medical marijuana card, either as a patient or as a caregiver, and that allows them to grow a certain number of plants.
I believe what you actually have to do is find a doctor that will write you.
Oh, that's true. You have to get a doctor's recommendation.
That's the problem. The law doesn't say you can obtain seeds here. You can go to this regulated place. They will sell it to you. That's where the law just
assumes
people would just like make seeds out of their
hands. And let's be clear, Tim Beck, who had a big hand in writing that 2008 law that probably a lot of you either voted for or against, he said they purposely wrote it to be confusing, and they purposely wrote it so there were this sort of Swiss cheese of laws so that we would all be having this conversation, because he thought if they did write it in such a way that made all of this clear, more people would probably vote against it. So
they got it on the books, and now we got to make it better.
Yeah. So right. I think it's time for prizes, because prizes are just fun. So Rick Pluta will do our first prize, and what we'll do, I think, is just Rick will ask the question, and then
ask people to raise their
okay, hands. We're going to do this. Yes.
A trivia question in three parts. The first part is, can I get a red rye PA, please? The second part is, who is the only president of the United States from Michigan? Okay, everyone knew that. I mean, I don't know. So now.
That was the warm-up.
This is the warm-up. Now the question, Who succeeded Gerald Ford in Congress when he became vice president?
Raise your hand.
Raise your hand.
Oh, someone raised their hand? Okay.
Wait, don't
no.
Anyone else? Anyone else?
It is a Vander.
It is a Vander. If that's helpful. Okay.
Who succeeded Gerald Ford in Congress when he became vice president?
Ooh, cricket.
Okay.
I think that means we go to another question.
We can. Do you want the answer?
Oh, right.
But, wait, you have it. Do you think you know it?
Says,
who? What?
My lifeline says it's Vandervoot.
What?
Voot.
No? Actually, but close.
Okay, let's give the answer.
Let's give it. Oh, wait. Oh, no, Kathy Gray, no way.
Oh, Kathy Gray is here. Let's all
ladies
give
and
a huge...
Kathy Gray of the Detroit Free Press.
Kathy Gray, a wonderful, wonderful Lansing political reporter from the Detroit Free Press is here.
What is it?
It can't be Vandenberg. That's...
No.
Nope.
Vandenberg.
I think it's
nope. He was the senator.
Guy Vanderjack.
No. Kathy. Oh. No. But you're close. Although, I mean, guessing a Dutch name from West Michigan. Richard Vanderveen was the first Democrat to represent Grand Rapids in Congress in 100 years. And now he did arguably go in on the post-Watergate Democratic wave, but he also had a pretty unique platform, which was that he would vote to impeach Richard Nixon and make Gerald Ford the first president from Michigan, which ultimately happened, although not exactly that way.
Okay, well, because we didn't get to give out a prize in that one, and we do have prizes to
we
give.
Do have prizes.
Let's give.
We're not leaving with this
no,
stuff.
No, exactly. So this is a true or false. So this is going to have to be quick hands shot up. True or false, there has never been a governor from the Upper Peninsula.
Raise your hand.
That's true.
That, my dear, is false. Right, exactly. 50-50, right? Yeah. Chase Osborne was governor from 1911 to 1913. And just as a little bit of trivia...
Bonus, Chase Osborne is buried on Sugar Island. What international organization was offered Sugar Island as a location for its headquarters? Hands up.
Hands up. Oh, I see a hand over here.
United Nations.
Correct.
We have our first prize of the evening.
The Sault Ste. Marie City Council nominated Sugar Island. It was never a serious contender. We assume that's just because New York had better politicians.
Okay, so let's quickly finish up some other things that are happening right now in... the legislature. We are now, tomorrow, the one-year anniversary of Right to Work. I'm hearing some boos. Have we really seen any political consequences of that, Chad, right now? Obviously, we haven't had an election since that's happened. It was such a big deal last year at this time. We're at the one-year anniversary. Where do things stand, politically speaking?
It's somewhat of a dud as far as there hasn't been any recalls like they were threatened. There hasn't been any ballot.
I want to jump in on that in a second, though.
Yeah, but at the same time, it did in many ways reshape the way this governor has been perceived publicly, because he definitely went against what he had said for quite a long time that it wasn't on his agenda. It's become kind of a joke, and he definitely does not say that. It's not in his vocab anymore. But other than that, we have yet to really see the effects labor has essentially signaled they're not going to try to go for the ballot again next year. That they spent a lot of money last year and failed, and then it was used against them essentially politically. So at this point, it's
I think labor is largely done with ballot questions after their you know last experiment
yeah,
with that.
I agree.
But
that.
There are two things that you know on the anniversary we're seeing the anti people saying that we have not seen the economic effects that the proponents of right to work promised, and we're seeing the people who were for right to work saying that we haven't seen the world collapse as the people who were opposed to it said. But the reality is that the effects of right to work were going to play out over a much longer period of time than just 12 months, and they will. And you know, and that's just something that we'll be actually be you know examining probably more fruitfully you know 5 years and 10 years down the road in a state like Michigan. We did not see the recalls that were threatened in part because as part of it, and this was planned, that part of the right to work political mop-up was to change Michigan's election laws so that recalls, which were really not all that difficult to get underway, would suddenly become very, very difficult. And so that was abandoned. But the other thing is that the organizations, both Republican and Democrat, liberal and conservative, when they did their internal polling, which is the stuff that drives the issues that they're going to use both in legislative debates and also on the campaign trail, found out that right to work really wasn't something that people were getting hot and bothered about one way or the other, which is why you are going to hear a lot more about the extending the income tax to pensions, and not put exactly that way, and school funding than you are about right to work.
And we'll talk a little bit
about that. Or they'll make it part of a broader, this has been an attack on working families.
I want to
get into the machinations of right
to
work
election,
and paying union dues.
I want to get into election 2014 in a little bit, but first let's round out.
I want a red IPA.
I think Rick Pluta is
asking
for a beer.
I would also like a red IPA.
Apparently some folks here before we continue need another beer. But please, all of you, feel welcome to. So let's talk a little bit finally about the legislature, but not something necessarily that the legislature is doing, but a group that wants to maybe stop what the legislature is doing. We are hearing a little bit, and we hear about this, it seems like, every year, but this idea of a part-time legislature. Can I quickly see hands, if you feel comfortable raising them, if you saw that on the ballot today and were voting, how many people would vote for a part-time legislature? Right. So this is something that I think to a lot of folks sounds like a really great idea. I think I heard someone in the audience yell, well, they're already part-time, even though Michigan is one of only, I think, 11 states.
Can I interrupt for just a second,
part-time
though?
Legislature. So let's talk quickly about, the signatures that are going around and whether or not we could actually see this on the ballot come November 2014.
Now, I have a follow-up question. How many people here consider themselves Democrats? Raise your hands. Largely the same group of people. How would you feel about that part-time legislature if you found out that the primary proponent of it at the moment is Republican National Committeeman and former state representative Dave Ajima?
Dave Ajima, who's made some news in the past day or two.
Crickets.
Did you? I mean, you know, I heard, oh my God.
Yeah.
I thought I heard someone barfing in the back.
Well, so let's quickly talk.
We have a couple of hands up in the back there.
Okay. So in a while Steve is going that way, what this ballot would do, at least in the language that some people are talking about, it would
this
make.
This is largely conceptual, right?
Yes. Yeah, but they say that Ajima is behind it. We're already, they're saying they're going to try to get some signatures. This would mean that for the first 3 months of the year, lawmakers would be at work, and then for the rest of the year, they wouldn't. And I think they would make, what, $35,000 a year?
Which, by the way, is what most states do.
Yeah,
most states have a part-time legislature.
I've covered two other legislatures in Delaware and Missouri that were part-time, And the Missouri guys made about 31,000, and the Delaware guys made about 40,000 under the part time. And Delaware met January through the through June 30th, but they had a huge like 2 or 3 month in the middle break, basically, where just the budget committee was meeting. And then in Missouri, it was they met the first week in January through the 15th of May. And I can tell you that what happens in part-time legislatures is you essentially cede a lot more power to the executive branch, and they're not watching very much about what's going on, even in places like Delaware is all Democratic legislature and governor, and they're essentially kind of the oversight is kind of lacking for the rest of the year. So there's some problems with that flexibility of lawmaking.
We have Steve in the back there with some people who have some questions. So.
Hi, you brought up the question about part-time legislature, but I think the more relevant question is about term limits and maybe eliminating term limits or what term limits has done to create our legislature as it is right now.
Who all here voted for term limits? Raise your hand.
I was going to say, who's...
The comment was, who's admitting
now,
it?
Who voted for them but won't admit it? Please raise your hands.
Yeah. Who thinks term limits is a good idea?
Huh.
Okay.
Right.
It's not that easy, but you know what? It's not that easy to repeal it now either. If it went on the ballot, it would win again.
Yeah, it would take a miracle to convince the public that term limits has been a bad idea. I mean, the most people just do not pay attention to the day-to-day things that we see where term limits has incredible shortcomings.
And one of the arguments, I think, too, against at least the part-time legislature and term limits is the idea that it also not only gives more power to the executive branch, it ends up giving more power to lobbyists and groups like ALEC with this idea, sort of model legislation.
The idea that you're going to pay, everyone wants to just give a legislator. Who here wants to give their legislature a pay cut? Just raise your hand if you want to cut the pay of lawmakers. Because you don't think they should get paid $76,000. I mean, most people would go for that because they like that idea of a part-time legislature. The problem is that when you have you pay someone $31,000 a year to be a part-time legislator, your entire legislature is made up of essentially either people who are retired,
or
people who are
wealthy.
Lawyers, or independently wealthy,
or living on a park bench.
Well, that's but you really do not have. A very good cross-section of the public. I mean, I saw that in Missouri, and that was really the problem
good
there.
Good to know. Do we have any other questions? Steve? Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not actually in favor of term limits, but I'm also not in favor of following Delaware's example. They're funded by credit card interest, you know, and I think all of us would agree that credit card interest is often too high. And I'm not in favor of following Missouri. You know, that's not a state I think Michigan should aspire to be like. Term limits, you say we can't repeal term limits. I think that there's probably some other people who would agree that we need a really smart, willing to sacrifice their business, their life, their whatever it is for a few years to serve the state. And does that happen if you have term limits? And
when it comes to addressing term limits, and we have some of the strictest term limits in the country, I think still. I think the best you can hope for if you are opposed to term limits is that Michigan will extend them so that term limits last somewhere closer to what the standard career of a legislator was pre-term limits, which was between, 12 and 18 years.
Yeah, and the way districts are so gerrymandered, I mean, even getting people out of voting a term limit legislator out of office in the middle of, like, their six years in the House and four or eight in the Senate, it's really quite hard to get that to begin with. And just to give you an example, in Missouri they had the same kind of term limits you have here in Michigan. In Delaware you had no term limits, and essentially you had to find Well, first of all, a lot of people just went out with their boots off. I mean, they died in office, basically, in Missouri or Delaware. Or you had to essentially catch their hand in the cookie jar in some type of a corruption to be able to even get a primary to get the money to raise to get them out of office. So there's back and forth. I mean, a lot of people think that the most simplest way to resolve this is kind of expand the term limits a little bit, more than 6 years, because the power turnover is so quick, that, and then also just the lack of institutional knowledge.
Well, the fact of the matter is
breathtaking at times.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that whether you have term limits or you don't have term limits, and I'm not saying that they're equal, but you are trading one set of problems for another, yeah, no matter what you do. Steve, you have a question?
In talking about the issue of looking at a part-time legislature, you often see government saying nonprofits need to be more efficient, other agencies need to be more efficient in the way they're doing business, and quite frankly, we have had a full-time legislature, and they accomplish very little. So wouldn't you say becoming part-time would force them to become more efficient? And if they are not forced to become more efficient, at what point do we say, okay, if you're not accomplishing anything at a full-time level, then, you know, what's the difference?
Well, let me throw the question back at you in a different way. How badly do you want an efficient legislature?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's plenty of folks who would look at this legislature and go, maybe they were a little too efficient. Maybe they're getting a little too much done.
We were just talking about right to work got passed in 6 days without a committee hearing. Yeah. If you think that the legislature jams through things now, you wait till they go to part-time and they change the rules and they can just drop bills and there's no 5-day limits. I mean, it will be even harder it will be a lot easier probably, I mean, to pass things in the middle of the night.
Efficiency, you know, is a merit, but you know, there are
and when
merits.
You put,
we choose flagship issues and we say, oh my God, look at all the legislation that they're passing, focusing on women's reproductive rights, for example. But then they accomplish nothing on anything else. So then my question is, okay, let's say efficiency and effectiveness. At what point do we say you're not accomplishing things in the areas that you should be because you use the
same thing? No. You're saying they're not accomplishing things in the areas that you would not like them to be.
So they're not being effective. Because if you're focusing your efforts on one thing,
if you're anti-abortion, this legislature is pretty effective.
Pretty effective, yeah.
But if you're a citizen, it's not effective in the ways that it needs to be.
If you're pro-choice, this legislature is not particularly.
And if you're being issue specific, they're effective. But if you're looking at the progress of the state, you're not improving our state by focusing on specific issues. I'm sorry.
Did you want to grab the microphone?
I was just going to say you're not answering her question.
Okay.
She's asking you about everything but that, and you keep talking about that.
Oh, okay. No. Okay. No. That's fair enough. And well, now you're talking about you're asking how should politicians be measured. If we're talking about term limits, the amount of time that they spend in Lansing. Well, it's how do you measure your effectiveness? And you know what? That is, there are roughly, I think, 6 million registered voters in Michigan, and there are 6 million answers as to how politicians should be measured for their effectiveness.
Let's. I want to move over to Detroit. I think we've sort of done the roundup of what's happening in the legislature.
But we love it here in Lansing.
We do, but there are so many things happening in Detroit. But first, I think we probably need another trivia question. Right.
Ready? Remember, raise your hands, give an answer. Which West Michigan lawmaker was the first legislature to propose adding sexual orientation protections to the Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act?
Jim Dressel.
Very good.
Very nice. Very nice.
Republican representative. I'm sorry?
Give him a shot.
He got a pint glass.
No, Republican representative Jim Dressel of Holland.
A shot in the pint glass he's asking for.
By the way, I knew him. He was the representative from my area, and he lost a primary challenge the following year to Al Hookman. Jim Dressel, who was the ranking Republican on the Transportation Committee, went on to be a consultant on transportation issues and a volunteer organizer for the Michigan Organization for Human Rights, which today is Equality Michigan. There is currently an effort underway in the Michigan legislature to add LGBT. All right.
Zubies delivers. The gentleman in the front did just get a shot. Not in the pint glass, though.
Don't say that Zubies doesn't listen.
Zubies, are you driving him home as well?
Zubies has wheelbarrow service. There is currently an effort underway, being spearheaded by a Republican from Charlevoix, to add LGBT protections to Michigan's civil rights law.
So, like I said, I want to move us all over quickly to Detroit. Oh, that, no, that was a segue. That was not anything about... So, Chad, live and good of the Detroit News. There was a junior senator from Kentucky in Detroit on Friday.
That's right. Rand Paul was in Detroit proposing a plan. He created... What is the term of it? I'm drawing a blank right now.
Well, it's basically
freedom,
it's
freedom zones.
It's basically rehashed Renaissance zones.
Yeah, and it's been proposed before. I think Newt Gingrich had something. It's kind of a warmed over idea.
Ronald Reagan had it before.
Try to take away the taxes as an offer to go set up a business or live in Detroit, and we'll see if it actually, you know, gets anywhere. Even I don't think it's going to get anywhere in the Senate. So
let's be a little dubious about why a junior senator from Kentucky would come to Detroit. Does it have anything to do with voter turnout come 2014?
Which, by the way, we should point out was to for a Republican Michigan Republican Party African American outreach office in Detroit, which even a lot of Republicans are saying is a really bad idea,
it's a waste of time, but there is going to be a little bit of an effort to try to promote the Republican approach to Detroit, because let's be honest, a Republican governor is running the city of Detroit right now, and he is trying to reshape it. He is trying to fix the city in bankruptcy. It is the nuclear option for Detroit, and he is trying to instill some of his ideals in this idea that we're going to tackle this issue, not kick it down the road. You're going to hear this in future elections, that we did something about Detroit, unlike the people who used to run Detroit, the Democrats. Maybe.
So do the Republicans politically, I don't want to say economically, politically right now own the narrative of Detroit?
Well, they own it, and they're going to have to own the results, too. And that means, you know, if pensions get cut in Detroit in bankruptcy, Rick Snyder will probably own that, and he'll have to account for that, he's already the governor who taxed your pension or most people's pensions, and now he's going to have to account for his emergency manager's actions in Detroit.
By the way, pensions are the third rail issue in the statewide 2014 elections. That is what so much of this is going to turn on, because every local government in Michigan has pensioners. Every local government is watching what's going on in Detroit. And everyone who has some kind of retirement income is looking at that with at least with some sense of I can relate to it. And also, everyone who is planning a campaign for 2014 knows that.
Yeah, because there's this narrative. I'll give you my example. My wife's grandma, she's a GM retiree, and she has a pension. A little short side story. She was originally being taxed by this pension, but there's so many loopholes, actually, to get out of this pension tax. If your spouse is over 67, you don't have to, and you joint file, you don't have to pay. And I got her out of the tax. I know the law a little bit. So
Chad's giving out business cards later at the end of the evening.
I've actually gotten a reader out of the tax too. I don't know, someone called. Anyway, so there. This is like Rick said. It does resonate with people. Bev said to me, "Look, this is awful. If these people take away their pensions, and so that's why I think you're going to start to see some type of way to try to resolve this, or or not not have a draconian cut to pensions in Detroit, because that will only be fodder in the 2014 election that Rick Snyder doesn't want to have. At the same time, he's got to figure out how to essentially protect the art of the DIA. I mean, we are in a moral hazard 101 right here. Do we essentially, you know, cut off, you know, slash grandma's pension check in half, or do we protect these world renowned artifacts that are in that museum? Well, the bondholders are going to get cut. Nobody really cares about the bondholders. I can tell you that they're going to get cut. They're going to get 10 to 20 cents on the dollar. But the problem with in bankruptcy, all creditors have to be treated the same. Okay, so if you count the pensions as a unsecured debt of Detroit, you have to give them the same 20 cents on the dollar. That's the way the code works. I'm not saying that it's right, but that's essentially the way it works. And unless there's some deal struck where they essentially get exempted, but even that they can try to fight that. It's not the bondholders who are going to lose money here in Detroit. It's the insurers of the bonds. All the bondholders have insurance. The pensioners don't have insurance on their pensions. And so it's these insurers, mostly out of New York, who are coming in trying to essentially fly-spec every dollar spent in Detroit. And they're saying, look, we want to question why you're spending money on these lights. We question why you're spending money on these cops. And we want to question why you're spending money on these pensions. Yeah. And so there's a lot of competing interests here, and it's a little bit out of the governor's now that he has opened Pandora's box here, it's a little out of his control.
Right. Yeah. We've got a question over here.
How many other Michigan cities are going to be in the same boat 5 years from now with their pensions?
Well, we actually, on one of our programs on Michigan Radio, just talked to a couple of municipal finance experts. Now, isn't that a sexy job title right there? Muni Finance is where it's at, in case you're interested. And there's
a Muni Finance expert sitting at the end of the bar who's just, like, waiting.
And, it is not just cities like Detroit. It is not just cities like Flint or Saginaw. When you actually look at unfunded liabilities, when you look at overhead and pension, you're looking at Bloomfield Hills. You're looking at Ann Arbor. You're looking at Lansing. These are all cities.
You're also looking at the state of Michigan and MIBSRS, the teachers' pension fund.
Yes. So Detroit is coming to a city near you unless some tough decisions are made, and that seems like a really crazy thing to think about. But when you actually do the numbers, there are cities all – I think it was actually over 80 different communities that actually, when you do per capita, are worse off than Detroit is right now.
Well, in some respects, Detroit is the war that's being fought in order to – avert other similar wars, other smaller wars.
Right, but
this comes down to, you all have heard that there is a constitutional provision in our Constitution adopted in 1963 that says pensions shall not be impaired or diminished. What the judge ruled last week is that provision makes pensions a contractual obligation. And contracts, reality is, get ripped up in bankruptcy court every day. And so the battle is that pension, that deferred compensation, a property right or a contractual right? And that's what this is all going to come down to. That's what the Supreme Court is going to be asked to eventually hear. On Monday, the judge is going to decide whether to allow this to be advanced to the Sixth Circuit of Court of Appeals. They're going to try to get they want to keep this bankruptcy moving fast. Because obviously it's in Rick Snyder's interest that this bankruptcy is not going
well,
on
also
in September
because
of next year.
Kevin Orr has just a limited amount of time in office.
And that's what I want to talk about next is this interesting dance that we're going to see come January when we have the new mayor-elect Mike Duggan take office as mayor of Detroit. And you have Kevin Orr, who right now is actually this month halfway through his term because of the new emergency manager law, how it's written. After 18 months, we are now at month 9 in his term. After 18 months... Say that again?
I'd like to comment about the 18-month clock.
Well, so Chad, this question is for you. It looks like after 18 months, what we understand is a majority of the city council can vote whether to two-thirds can vote to get rid of the emergency manager. That will come about a month before election 2014. Help us understand a little bit about whether Kevin Orr would stay on, whether Snyder would appoint a different emergency manager.
Here's a little funny, little dirty little secret in the emergency manager law. Even when the 18 months expires just before, a couple days before, Rick Snyder can appoint another emergency manager in Detroit who then the 18-month clock starts over. It happened when Jack Martin took over Detroit Public Schools in May, about 2 months into the clock on Roy Roberts, and they will likely do that. I mean,
here's another one, this idea that there's a term limit. The emergency manager can also appoint appoint a deputy emergency manager who has almost the exact same authority going forward after the emergency manager
leaves.
Which
is what Lou Schimmel did in Pontiac,
exactly.
But, gentlemen, there's something called the optics of politics, and would the governor, weeks before he was up for re-election with Mark Schauer running against him, would he actually do such an audacious thing when, you know, I mean, would he?
Wait, Chad. Give me an answer in one word. One, two, three.
Yes. And I saw David Waymire in the back going like
well,
this.
If David Waymire is saying yes, then that must be the correct answer.
Yeah, and the other thing is the law has a built-in, there's a provision in the emergency manager law that allows for the appointment of a board to remain in control of the finances of Detroit, and they will have veto power over labor contracts and operating budgets. They put one in E-Course. I think there's one in Pontiac now. So there will be a state control of Detroit for probably
A very long time.
Probably 10, 15 years.
We've got a question. I would like whatever beer Waymire is having to be put on the Michigan radio tab. And now to the question.
Because he answered the question from the back?
Yes, Steve, you've got a question in the back.
Let's go backwards for just a second.
Sure.
The Republicans got us all to go into 401ks, and the average retiree now has $35,000 instead of a fixed benefit contract. And now they're saying because everybody lost money for the last 5 years in the stock market, therefore all of the retirement things are wrong. It's another bullshit thing run by the Republicans and Alec. And I think we ought to look at this a lot more closely. Those retirement funds are not in that bad shape. Some are. Detroit obviously is. Flint obviously is. But a lot of them are not. And they're not supposed to be funded at 100%. They don't have to pay out everything tomorrow.
The reality is
what's going on here.
I understand that, but the political reality is they're using some of the examples, some of the somewhat audacious examples of way Detroit was managed. One of the things that essentially where Kwame Kilpatrick's downfall began was in 2005. He went around to city council and he was in a cash crunch. He could not afford to pay all the bills, and so he went around the city council and lobbied them. With the help of some players in town, to take out an IOU on the pension fund of $1.4 billion. And they got this money loaned to them at an interest rate of 6% on a kind of a complicated interest rate swap, which I won't even bore you with. And they took out this loan. They put the money into the fund, and that is where you can document the corruption that began, because they got his cronies on the board and they started investing in all kinds of real estate transactions, you know, local companies, the friends of Kilpatrick. We know the story. It all happened. It transpired over the last 7-8 years. But the point is that they borrowed all this money, this known as certificates of participation or COPS, and then they got involved in these interest rate swaps. I call it COPS and swaps. I like to call it. It's literally the swap that swallowed Detroit, because that's literally what happened. And so now they're trying to undo all this, and they're going to use these examples of the cops as a justification why we got to do this. At the same time, they're also using the 13th check, which was a practice for 30 years, where they essentially took all proceeds, all profits above 8%, and instead of reinvesting it in the pension fund and making the pension fund last as long as possible, they just cut checks, to, annuity checks, to every pensioner.
But everything happens also in the moment. I remember Michigan, too, back in the 90s, stopped pre-funding pensions. Yeah. And that helped pay for tax cuts.
Yeah, this is true. And so my point is that
we've got to go back to Steve and a question in the back there.
In the event that the pensioners lose something as a result of this bankruptcy proceeding, they don't qualify for Social Security currently. If their benefits,
some of them don't. Cops don't. Firefighters don't.
So in the event that their benefits are cut as a result of the bankruptcy proceeding, is there any precedent to allow them to obtain any of that difference from Social Security?
No. Absolutely. No, there's not. And I mean, would that take – it would take an unprecedented act of Congress to make up the difference. I mean, that would be labeled a bailout, basically.
Well, again, but that also gets back to that question of what do we do about pensioners that – you know, Democrats – won, and in the last House elections, I think only two seats north of Clare.
Right.
And there are a lot of pensioners up there. And if Republicans are going to be viable as a party over the long term, north of Clare, and that matters in terms
of winning the
political
House.
Control in the legislature, that they're going to have to handle those concerns.
Yeah, they're going to get
It's amazing how politically, Democrats have been driven out of the North, and we could see an incredible comeback based on that issue alone. And that's Republican polling that says that.
There's a lot of things the state could do without, short of giving writing a check to Detroit. The biggest thing is the city struggles to collect income tax. It struggles to collect tax in general. 47% of Detroit property owners didn't pay their taxes in 2011 for a whole host of reasons that range from they're poor, they can't afford it, to why should I pay taxes for a city that doesn't have lights on my street and I can't get a cop within 57 minutes. And then there is the issue of income tax. 54% of Detroiters are reverse commuters. They drive into the suburbs or take a bus to a job. And their suburban employer is not required to remit their taxes. Anybody that lives around here has probably run into this, where if they live in Lansing and you work out at the Lansing Mall, the store in the mall will not collect your tax. There's an income tax issue where we don't require suburban employers to remit taxes. And for Detroit, it's north of $100 million by all estimations. It could be a very big thing for the city if the state would step in and require that. I constantly ask this question to lawmakers. Why is it fair that the guy who lives in Plymouth drives into the city and works? Has anybody ever worked in the city of Detroit for an employer? You get your taxes taken out. There's almost no way of getting around it. I mean, unless you work for some contractor or you're a lawyer and you know how to evade it.
The question for the guy in Plymouth is?
The question for the guy in Plymouth, why is it fair for the guy in Plymouth? Well, he gets his taxes taken out by the employer in the city of Detroit, but that Detroiter who works in Plymouth doesn't get their taxes taken out because there's no law requiring that business in Plymouth to remit and collect those taxes. Yeah. Anybody who's ever paid taxes knows
no
you don't pay taxes
right. Okay.
Unless
Zoe.
You're required.
So. Yes, so I think it is time for trivia.
Okay, set up question.
Drum roll, please.
What is the name of the chair of the Michigan Democratic Party? Just yell it out.
Lon Johnson. But there is not only one Lon Johnson in this
there
world.
There are at least two other Lon Johnsons of note. Can you name, and raise your hand,
what
at least
profession?
One their claim to some measure of fame? Raise your hand.
And I love that you are embarrassed that you know this, and I want to hear the
Stop.
Answer.
But I don't remember it.
Yeah,
okay. No, not going to go for it.
Who are the other famous Lon Johnsons?
There are at least two that we know of, other famous Lon Johnsons. Can you name the profession of at least one of them? Oh, no phones allowed.
No phones. Come on.
One of them's a cat on YouTube.
What?
One of them is a cat on YouTube.
No, one of them is not a cat on YouTube.
There very well could be, but that is nowhere near as exciting as what we have as an answer.
Okay.
No one?
All right.
Stump the crowd.
All right, we stumped the crowd. All right, two. There is the Lon Johnson School for Aspiring Adult Film Actors. See, you should have guessed. You should have guessed.
You knew that, didn't you?
There is also the Lon, although it's actually Lonnie Johnson, who invented the Super Soaker water gun. Well, now you remember.
A little late, but we do have a follow-up question for the prize. What high-profile job did President Obama give Michigan's Lon Johnson, chair of... Oh, yes, shall I finish the question, or you're just...
The Easter Bunny Rabbit?
Oh,
you win.
Very nice. Very nice. Do you want to... Should you finish off the answer for those folks who read the whole thing?
Well... Right. Our Lon Johnson of Kalkaska County, Michigan, is married to Juliana Smoot, who is President Obama's superstar campaign fundraiser.
She ran the financial operations, yeah.
Yeah. And yes, the former social secretary. Yep. And so the president had a job that needed to be done. Someone needed to wear that Easter Bunny suit. And as Lon Johnson said, when the President of the United States asks, you hop to it.
Oh, shots all around.
He really did say that.
And there is a Christmas party that I think Lon is going to next week. We don't have any word yet whether he will play Santa or not, whether this is, you know, a continuing thing or not for him. So speaking of Lon Johnson, speaking of elections, let's talk now in the last 20 minutes or so about election 2014. Gentlemen, you brought up the fact about Democrats winning above Claire. I want to talk a little bit about some of the congressional races to watch come 2014. Let's start with the first congressional district, Benishek versus Cannon.
One of the hottest congressional races in the country.
Makes everyone
is
a little hot
Michigan's-
just talking about it.
Is in Michigan's North Country.
Right. So why is this a race to watch?
Well, it's...
That's a new question.
Because the numbers for the Democrats are not as bad as you would think, considering the way that their prospects have been of late, that Dan Benishek is in his second term, that you don't want to bet against an incumbent, but that the Democrats think that they have a quality candidate in the Kalkaska County Sheriff, former Kalkaska County Sheriff, and former Army General Jerry Cannon. Yes, an Army General's name is Cannon. who they think that will appeal to the largely retired military and military sympathetic population of northern lower Michigan and the upper peninsula. And one of the reasons that they have a little bit of hope in that is the idea of running someone who's not from the UP in that district used to be ridiculous. But now, even though there's the population center of Marquette in the UP, but there's also Traverse City, Alpena, that more than half of that district now lives below the bridge.
And there are some signs, too,
trolls.
Right? The trolls. That Republicans might be a little bit worried about the seat. Dan Benishek was the only Republican who was asked during the 2012 National Convention to speak from Michigan, the only Republican. No one else was. Money is being pumped into that race.
And still no one remembers that speech.
I do. Let's move on to the 7th congressional district. We have Tim Walberg tell me how you really feel. We have Tim Walberg versus Pam Burns. What are we looking at in that race?
That is just a fascinating development that Tim Walberg... Broken glass. Now it's a party.
Party foul.
Tim Walberg succeeded in the last round of redistricting in eliminating his two nemeses, one from the Democratic Party and one from the Republican Party, but both of them in Battle Creek and Calhoun County from his district, and putting them into the – is it the third that's Justin Amash's?
Yes.
Into the third. And all of a sudden, his new nemesis is now from the east end of his district, Pam Burns, a reasonably moderate Democrat who's making a strong enough run that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is putting some money into it. And she may, if in fact public opinion is turning dramatically on the question of gay rights, and it is a bellwether question, she may be the beneficiary of sort of a happenstance from her last campaign for the state Senate, that she was trying to make herself more acceptable in a very liberal Ann Arbor. And so she was the first Michigan lawmaker to propose an amendment to the state constitution to repeal the gay marriage ban.
Right, right. That was a few years ago. And it's interesting, though, when you read releases from her office, that that has not been mentioned as one of the things that she has done yet.
Doesn't need
but
to
this
be.
But this is still a solidly – it leans right, leans Republican district. It there's very much a very rural aspect to it. Tim Wahlberg's from Lenawee County. Yeah. He's got a lot of support
and
in
Ann
Hillsdale,
still is
Jackson
a dingle,
County.
Is dingle.
And this part, I'm actually from Chelsea, from Pam Burns' marching or stomping grounds. It is, you know, there's a very small area of the whole entire district that is actually Washtenaw County, Western Washtenaw
right,
County.
Right.
So, and it's not a lot of Ann Arbor.
No.
It's a little piece of Scioto
Township. Well, who's the organic farmer?
Sharon Rainier.
That
yes.
ever since she made like a credible run at it, that Democrats have sort of felt like there's just this ineffable thing there that they could grab it. And there are a few districts that are like that. That there's the old Thad McCotter district that Democrats are suddenly which is another one that was made much
like,
more
Republican. It's like you read my mind, Rick. Let's go to the 11th district now where we're seeing a Trot versus Benevolio, at least in the primary. Let's talk a little bit about the reindeer farmer first and sort of the candidate that
it's the reindeer farmer versus the foreclosure king.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, right. This is a district, a lot of people know the story. Kerry Benevolio is this no-name...
the luckiest politician in America.
Republican who
I think the actual nickname is the accidental congressman.
Who manages to figure out how to find 1,000 people to put him on the ballot, and he gets on the ballot, and all of a sudden the incumbent congressman fails to get on the ballot because of... this widespread scandal where his staffers forged signatures and did a big copy and paste job, and so Thad McCotter goes down, he resigns from Congress. Kerry Benevolio is nominated, then loses the special election, and then just because of Republican majorities, he wins the general election, and now he's facing re-election for the first time. And he's going up against David Trot, a foreclosure attorney and wealthy Republican,
but who's very, very connected in the Oakland County Republican Party.
So, right. Do we agree
and
that
Kerry Benevolio is not connected in the right. Oakland County Republican Party, and they don't really like him, and the machine is essentially out to get rid of him because they think that look, this is not. You have not been preordained to be the congressman from our district, so we're going to
although
get rid
the
of
interesting
you.
Thing is that he has, despite running as an outsider, that he has tried very hard to play ball with the leadership.
He has. He got John Boehner to come into the district and raise money for him.
Eric
Cantor was here. I mean, he has, but he is even with the big names, he has struggled to raise money, and he has even admitted privately at a Tea Party group meeting back in last month that he's going to probably lose because of this.
But he still has lifetime benefits to the house gym and floor privileges.
Right. Yeah. So do we agree that it's the primary to watch rather than the actual?
Yeah, it's a primary. I mean, the Dems are going to make a shot at trying to win this seat. They got this candidate McKenzie,
Bobby McKenzie,
yeah.
And he's actually been moved up into their sort of. Their promising class,
right?
The D-triple-C.
We're going to work on you, class.
Yeah, that we see an opportunity here, and you know, if things move in the right direction, but it is not a district that was drawn that way. And I would say that this was more a district. This was a district drawn more to be a Republican district than a McCotter district, compared to say. The Wahlberg district, which was drawn to be a Wahlberg
district. Yeah.
And so the Democrats are going to have a much harder time there.
So let's go from those tiny little fish of congressmen to senators. Let's talk about the open Senate seat come 2014. We have Gary Peters versus what's looking like Terry Lynn Land. Are we willing to say that those are the two candidates and we're not going to see much change there?
Well, we've been through about every Republican office holder in the state, and none of them want to run for this seat. So it's Terry Lynn Land pretty much to lose.
By default?
Yeah. Well, somewhat by default, yeah. And so this is a pretty – and right now the polling right now is pretty dead even, statistically tied. You got a former Secretary of State who two terms, and you got a sitting congressman from what I call the Snake District down in the 14th, which is – that run somehow from the east side of Detroit to Pontiac, and if you can draw that in your mind, and it runs through the Bloomfields and Farmington along the ways.
It is, and actually the race to to replace Gary Peters is getting kind of interesting just because there's no communities of interest. But yeah, that Gary Peters is the selection of Carl Levin. He was, from the moment Levin decided to retire, that Republicans went from somewhere just a little north of opposed to acceptance to almost embracing Terry Lynn Land. And it's really, the only thing that she suffers from is she had a really bad debate performance that torpedoed her gubernatorial ambitions that made everyone wonder whether she was up for this task. But other than that, her numbers have actually been pretty good.
Well, other than that, or when you actually look at history, which is it's been 60 years and only one Republican, Spence Abraham, has been elected towards Senate, do we think it's just sort of Gary Peters' race? I mean, where do things stand? Okay, it's close right now. How many people are actually watching this race? When it comes to November, who wins?
National Republicans are watching this race because National Republicans realize they've squandered the last two election cycles with candidates like Sharon Engel in Nevada and Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, who I covered, and what was the gentleman's name in Indiana? The guy who said you can't get pregnant from... right. Yeah. What was his name? I've already forgotten some of these people. So the Republicans, they realize this is their last chance to take back the Senate during President Obama's presidency. And so they're going to try to put money into this race and other ones that they think that are winnable because they've essentially tried to work their magic to federal
elections. Republicans do not have a good history in federal elections in Michigan.
No.
That the last Republican senator was Spence Abraham, but the last time that a Republican won the Senate was under the exact same configuration of circumstances that we're going to see next year. Yet we still see, Terry Land. I get the impression that Gary Peters is running in the general election for the U.S. Senate. Terry Land is still running like she's trying to win a Republican primary against a still non-existent opponent.
Right. And at the same time, Peters is going to face issues with Obamacare and his vote for it and some statements he made where he essentially repeated the president's line if you like your health insurance plan, you can keep it. So he's going to have to fight that issue. And at the same time, Terry Lynn Land sometimes makes mistakes and stumbles around. And I had her on, I guest hosted Michael Patrick Shields radio show a few weeks ago. And I had her on
back to back.
And I asked her, are you one of these folks who wants to repeal this law or fix it? And she said, I want to fix it. I want to improve the law. And then, like, hours later, she was sending out tweets and Facebook messages and emails to supporters saying, I'm going to repeal Obamacare. And it was a total 180.
Which she's not.
And I think it was the same right. That was the same day of interviews also where she wouldn't say whether or not if she got to the Senate she would
I
support.
I asked her
right.
very several times whether she would support Mitch McConnell to be the majority leader if they win the majority. Even yeah. the
which is exactly
leader,
my point, is that she's still acting like she's running in a Republican primary yeah. instead of acting like she's won the Republican primary.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So we've sort of saved the big enchilada in the last 5 minutes. I think we have to talk about Snyder and Mark Schauer and the race for governor. Latest poll numbers are coming out, and it looks like Snyder's ahead by a few points, but it's within the margin of error. Is it just still
by the way
too
don't
early?
Believe any polls that you are seeing this far out from the election, period.
Yeah, you gotta wait till next spring at the earliest before you start really judging whether these polls are no, because people don't even know who Mark Schauer is, and he's polling well, which doesn't say a lot about the governor, but at the same time
do you think it says a lot about Mark Schauer? Does it say more about Snyder?
Let me ask you this. Who's looking forward to the debates between Rick Snyder and Mark Schauer?
Oh, my God, how boring. Mark Schauer.
Anyone?
Mark Schauer.
Yeah. Okay, so in the last few minutes, Chad, 30 seconds, what does the governor run on? What is his message coming up to November 2014?
He's going to jump on every economic indicator that looks good for him, even if he didn't actually cause it. I mean, he's going to talk about whatever that looks good. He's also going to talk about things that they did in state government to try to rein in the cost of state government, and you're also going to try to talk about the so-called reinvention of state government. They're going to talk about those issues. And you know, if you look at the campaign ad they ran out, this little five-minute video they rolled out on Mackinac Island, I mean, that really tells the story about what they're going to make this okay. make him about, you know, the guy who makes the decisions.
And Rick, 30 seconds, what is Mark Schauer running on?
Well, I'll give you them both. That no matter how anemic the recovery,
okay.
Rick Snyder will claim that it's ahead of the national pace and that we are setting the pace for the nation, that no matter how vigorous the recovery, that it will be not because of Rick Snyder, but because of other things, primarily the auto industry recovery, and it was Barack Obama.
Just in general, Barack Obama. Right. Okay.
No, that's right.
Okay. So. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News, thank you so, so much. And before we end this evening, Steve Krupinski is going to do our drawing, who the lucky winner is of the Issues and Ale prize pack. The last Issues and Ale of 2013 goes
Rick
to...
Rick Pluta. And the winner is... Zachary Spitnally.
Zach, are you here?
Come on down.
You're the next winner of.
I won. I won.
Oh, are we? No, Zachary.
Is Zachary here?
Is Zachary here?
Spitnally.
He just left.
Wah, wah, wah.
Got to be here to win.
As we said before, you must be present.
You
got to
hear again because after you win, you have to go through the spanky machine.
Alex Netsky. All right, Alex.
Yay! No, Alex, come on. want. And Alex,
come on up.
I would just like to give a shout out quickly. Alex is here with Michigan Radio's wonder producer, Allie Billings, who is here.
Allie!
Allie is a lifeline at Michigan Radio. Anything you hear at Michigan Radio, Allie has probably had a hand in.
But not this.
Yeah. But everything but this. Okay, well, everyone, thank you so much for coming out tonight. I know it was a cold night. Thank you.
And thank you to Zubies.
Sam Short, and the staff at Zubies. You guys have been awesome. Thank you so much for making us feel so comfortable and welcome. It was a really cozy evening. Thank you. And everyone, thanks so much for coming out tonight. It was a lot of fun. Hope you guys had fun, too.
And It's Just Politics, 1:35 p.m. every Friday on Michigan Radio.
Yes. Woo!